Welcome to Mattis Avenue Free Methodist Church, where we worship God, make disciples of Jesus Christ, and serve our community and world. The following is a recorded message based on God's holy word. We would love to see you for our worship services on Sunday mornings. For more information, visit www.mattisav.org or call 217-355-5947. And may God bless you.
Say supernatural, miraculous tone just permeates this entire account, doesn't it? The angel, the Holy Spirit, the prophetic utterance, Son of God being conceived by a miracle in Mary's womb, Elizabeth's pregnancy, despite the fact that she was older and formerly unable to have children, all of those elements demonstrate that something dramatic, something miraculous was taking place. Three times this passage says that Mary was a virgin. By the way, there's no alternative translation for that Greek word that's used here. The Bible's very clear about the fact that Mary was a virgin. Now, outside of that fact, we don't really know a whole lot about Mary's background. Comparing verses from other gospel writers, some have concluded that Mary had a sister named Salome, who was the mother of Zebedee's sons, the disciples James and John. Luke's genealogy refers to Mary's father as Heli. We know that Elizabeth was her relative, but otherwise all we know was that she spent her early life in Nazareth as the daughter of a poor, hardworking family. Now, scholars believe that Mary was likely in her late teens when she had her profound and life-changing experience with God. We just don't have much information about her background. But we do know several things about the kind of person she was. Let me change gears for a minute. I'm going to come back to this. After our first child, Greg, was born into our family, we realized that we needed to have our wills revised with instructions regarding the care of any children that God would give to us. I mean, if both Cheryl and I were killed in an accident, what would happen to our children? We didn't want the state deciding who would get custody, so we chose a couple ourselves whom we knew would care for our children well. We wanted a couple who had values that we shared concerning God and church and family life and education and so forth. And we wanted someone with a little experience. We didn't want our children to be somebody's first-time experiment. What if you had to make that decision? Whom would you choose? Think you would choose a couple of teenagers who were not yet married? God did when he chose guardian parents for his only son. God didn't choose a middle-class, secure, highly educated couple, but two poor teenagers from Nazareth who were engaged to each other but not yet married. Now, why did God choose Mary to be the mother of his son? Well, I believe one reason is because of her strong faith. Mary was confronted by the angel Gabriel, who announced that she was God's choice to conceive and bear the Messiah, the Son of God. Now, we can only imagine what was going through her mind and her heart at this point. Who is going to believe that I have conceived as a virgin? How is Joseph going to react to this news? What's going to happen to our wedding plans? What will my parents and my friends in Nazareth think? Let me just remind you of a little background information about marriages in those days. Engagement in that culture didn't mean the same thing that it does today. The rabbinical writings distinguished two stages in Hebrew marriages. There was the kedushin, or the betrothal period, that was as legally binding as marriage. If at any time during the kedushin either of the couple violated the vows or was found to be unchaste, a formal divorce was required to nullify the marriage contract. In other words, the two parties were, in every sense, legally married. They were even called husband and wife, but they had no sexual relations whatsoever, and they lived in separate homes. The kedushin was normally between 6 and 12 months. It was intended to prove the fidelity of both the husband and the wife. And if either partner was unfaithful, the contract was broken and divorce for infidelity was granted. The second stage of the Hebrew marriage, the huppah, was very much like the modern wedding, only it was a much larger event, occasion. It lasted for 7 days. Now, Mary's pregnancy began during the Kiddushin. She and Joseph had entered into this marriage contract, but they were still living separately when 9 months before that first Christmas, the angel Gabriel appeared to Mary. No doubt, Joseph was looking forward to the day when he and Mary would come together as husband and wife. No doubt, he was jolted by the news of her pregnancy. He knew the quality of her character. He knew the righteous standards by which she lived. He knew her commitment to God. He also knew premarital pregnancy was totally out of character for her. It just made no sense at all. The law of Israel demanded that a woman who became pregnant with a child outside of marriage should be put to death. So Joseph was shaken to the very core of his soul. Had they been living back in Moses' day, Mary would have been immediately stoned. But the laxness of the Jewish theocracy and the infiltration of the Roman law in Joseph's day gave him two other options. One is he could make a public example out of her. That is, he could charge her with adultery in a public court. She would be shamed. She would be brought to trial. She would be convicted in front of everybody and forever ruined in terms of her reputation. The other possibility was that Joseph could quietly, before two or three witnesses, write her a bill of divorce and end their relationship. There would be no fanfare. Nobody would need to know. She could simply go somewhere and secretly bear and raise the child. Now, back to our text with all that as background. With all the potential disasters ahead of her, think about it. Alienation from home, excommunication from the synagogue, a broken engagement, perhaps a ruined reputation. Mary responded to the angel with words that revealed the strength of her faith. I am the Lord's servant. May it be to me as you have said. What a great example of faith. Two sentences, and her life was never again the same. I am the Lord's servant. May it be to me as you have said. Now, the most wonderful thing about those two sentences is that they are not exclusive property of the Virgin Mary. You and I may freely plagiarize. We can borrow, copy, adopt, adapt, and make them our very own. You know, God always honors a faith like Mary's. He won't ask of you or me what he did of Mary, but his desire for your life and mine is the same: abandonment, availability, and allegiance. How abandoned are you to God's will? How much of your life is available to God to direct or redirect? Have you given God your total allegiance? Now, something is wrong with our faith if we have to have all the whys and the hows and the results outlined in black and white before we obey God. When it comes to faith, Mary's a great example to us, a model. According to Hebrews 11:6, without faith, it's impossible to please God. The angel said, "For nothing is impossible with God." Mary believed that to be true, and that's good news for some of us, for all of us, actually. Very good news for some of us. And I've been reading over and praying over the cards that you shared with me a couple of weeks ago from our service of prayer for the healing of human hurts. And I have to tell you, my heart has been broken as I have been more aware of some of the heavy burdens that some of you are carrying. I know we all try to put a good face on things. We don't want to burden other people with our problems. I know that some of you are dealing with some really significant hurts and challenges. Some of you are facing financial strain and you're feeling rather desperate. Some of you are dealing with huge physical challenges. Some of you are looking at your own marriage or that of loved ones that seem to be teetering on the brink of collapse. Some of you are estranged from members of your own family, and there is just a great need for healing of relationships in your family. Some of you have children or other loved ones who are far away from God. Some of you are struggling with serious bouts of anxiety or depression or loneliness or self-loathing. Some of you feel lonely and far away from God yourselves. The list goes on. But I want to tell you, all these have this in common. They seem impossible to solve by human means, and for the most part they are. But let me remind you from the teachings of our text today that Christmas is all about miracles. They happened 2,000 years ago, and they can still happen today. And as the chorus we sang 2 weeks ago put it, God, any rivers you think are uncrossable, God, any mountains you can't tunnel through, God specializes in things thought impossible. He does things others cannot do. I believe that with all my heart. Another reason why I believe God chose Mary to be the mother of his son is because of her faithful obedience. Mary's life was hard and difficult. And although the angel said that she among all women was highly favored, hers was not exactly the kind of favor most of us want from God. A few days before her baby's birth, she was required to take a long, painful journey to Bethlehem. I suppose that those of us who have not experienced the last few weeks of pregnancy can't fully appreciate what Mary endured on that trip. You know, some of you know this story. Back on July 19th, 1984, Cheryl and I decided to head from Lincoln, Illinois to Greenville, Illinois for annual conference. Cheryl was, let's say, great with child. Now, she's always been great with children, but at this point, she was great with child, okay? We had been in and out of the hospital in Lincoln on false alarms for about a month. And now we find out our doctor goes on vacation. So we decided to head on down to conference since I was to be ordained elder and since Cheryl was convinced she's never going to have this baby anyway. Because we had gone to Greenville College, we knew several of the doctors there in Greenville, and so we set out. Now, about 40 miles south of Lincoln, Cheryl turns to me and she says, this is it. And I said, well, honey, do you want to turn around and go back to Lincoln, or do you want to go on another 60 miles and drive down to Greenville? Of course, we didn't have any cell phone or anything back then. And she said, well, all our family's coming to Greenville for your ordination, and we don't know any of the doctors in Lincoln, and we know doctors. Let's hope we find somebody down in Greenville. So we drove down to Greenville, and we checked in with the doctor there as soon as we arrived, and the doctor immediately sent us to the hospital, and Rachel was born 2 hours later. At 4:06, while at the church, the delegates to conference were standing singing, "To God Be the Glory," only appropriate. Now, I say all that to say this. Riding for 2 hours in an air-conditioned car on an interstate, knowing where you're going, that medical care is readily available, is one thing. It was nerve-wracking enough. But imagine a 3-day trip over terrain, rough terrain, while riding on the back of a donkey. Would you call that highly favored? And finally, in Bethlehem, no rooms available. When it's time to give birth, only a dirty stable, perhaps the company of some barn animals, were offered to her. Then soon after giving birth, another hard trip is required of her. It wasn't to go back home. Instead, because of the fears and suspicions of Herod, she had to leave her homeland and flee to the foreign country of Egypt. I can only imagine how much she wanted to be with her family and her people. And yet, she faithfully obeyed. She didn't question God's will, but maintained the attitude from the very beginning, "I am the Lord's servant." Now, a third reason I believe that God chose Mary to be the mother of his son is because of her simple humility. She really had every reason from a human viewpoint to be full of pride, didn't she? She had every reason to demand special attention and treatment. I mean, just consider what was said to her. An angel of the Lord said, "Greetings, you who are highly favored. The Lord is with you." Now think about that for a minute. You know, my younger brother, Steve, has a close-up picture, 8x10 picture of himself shaking hands with President Reagan when he stopped off for a political rally back in Springfield back in 1988. Steve was living with us at the time. President arrived in Air Force One out at the airport, and of course, many dignitaries went out to greet him. Steve was working for the Senate Republican staff at the time, but he was just a pipsqueak in the organization. But he managed to get in line with all the dignitaries, and he has this great picture of him looking eyeball to eyeball and shaking hands with President Reagan. And you know, he's proud of that picture. I'll tell you what, if I had a chance to shake hands with the President of the United States, I would feel honored. But that doesn't even compare to having God's angel, Gabriel, come and tell you that you are highly favored with God and he is with you. Now that would make you feel proud. Not only that, but Mary's relative Elizabeth, who was a walking miracle herself, an elderly lady who had been barren, finally pregnant, exclaims to Mary, "Blessed are you among women. Blessed is the child you will bear." That might make you feel a little proud. Then add to that some of the things that happened later, like the fact that shepherds told her what happened to them, that the angel told them a Savior, Christ the Lord, is born, and a whole host of heavenly beings joined in celebrating the good news. Then there's the godly old people, Simeon and Anna, in the temple declaring that Mary's son is the world's salvation. And add to that, magi arriving from another country who have traveled for months to come and see her child to give him gifts and worship him. You put that all together, that's pretty heady stuff. And God's special guidance had been showered upon Joseph and Mary and the baby through angels and dreams and prophecies and visions and a guiding star and physical protection from Herod's madness. What was said and done would have been enough to make anybody proud, make them arrogant. And yet Scripture tells us that Mary treasured all she heard, pondered in amazement. She didn't allow any of it to make her prideful. There's no indication that she ever lost her attitude of being a humble servant. And after the birth of Jesus, we catch only a glimpse of Mary's life. Not much is recorded for us to her credit. She was great because she was unselfish. She brought the Messiah into the world and raised him, and in no way did she overshadow him. And because Mary was focused on God, she's a wonderful model for us today. Mary's faith, her obedience, and her humility are wonderful virtues. But I want to call your attention to one other thing about Mary that's quite instructive for us. Notice with me what she teaches us about worship. In verses 46 to 55, she launches into a song, a hymn of unspeakable joy, arguably the most magnificent psalm of worship in the New Testament, traditionally known as the Magnificat, which is the first word from the Latin translation of this passage. One could argue that it's equal to or greater than any of the Old Testament psalms, very reminiscent of Hannah's hymn of praise for the birth of Samuel. Listen to Mary's uplifting words as recorded in Luke 1, 46 to 55. And Mary said, "My soul glorifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God, my Savior, for he has been mindful of the humble state of his servant. From now on, all generations will call me blessed, for the mighty one has done great things for me. Holy is his name. His mercy extends to those who fear him from generation to generation. He has performed mighty deeds with his arm. He has scattered those who are proud in their inmost thoughts. He has brought down rulers from their thrones, but has lifted up the humble. He has filled the hungry with good things, but has sent the rich away empty. He has helped his servant Israel, remembering to be merciful to Abraham and his descendants forever, just as he promised our ancestors." Now, Mary's hymn of praise is instructive to us. Throughout the song, she describes a God who is concerned about those for whom it seems no one else is concerned. He is a God who came to lift up the lowly. This is what stunned Mary. that God would want her for his holy task. Verse 48, for he has been mindful of the humble state of his servant. Mary wasn't worthy. She didn't deserve it. But somehow, God wanted her. And she talked about the fact that he lifted up the humble, the forgotten, the helpless, the powerless, the needy. Those were the ones God cared about. They were the ones to whom he was going to bring good news. Remember what John the Baptist did when he was thrown into prison? He sent his disciples to Christ with one simple question. Are you the one we're waiting for, or should we look for another? And Christ answered with these words, go back and tell John what you have seen. The sick are healed, the deaf hear, the blind receive the sight, the dead are raised, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. Now at first glance, that last phrase may seem out of place, but not to Jesus. It's the genius of the Christian faith, friends, that it goes out first to the poor of the world, the hungry, the hurting, the needy, the homeless, the forgotten classes of mankind. And the message of the Magnificat is that God is always on the side of the lowly. He's always on the side of the hurting. He's always on the side of the handicapped, the deaf, the blind, the lame, the feeble. He's on the side of those who can't take care of themselves. Secondly, God's a God who came to have mercy on the needy. That's another part of Mary's song. We read in verse 50, his mercy extends to those who fear him from generation to generation. Verse 54, she's saying, he has helped his servant Israel, remembering to be merciful to Abraham and his descendants. God cared for that ragtag group of Jewish people who had rebelled against him so many times and were scattered abroad and helpless. And all through Mary's song is an indication of a God who knew those whom everyone else had forgotten about, who cared about those whom everybody else passed by on the other side. He was the God of mercy who loved the unlovely. That's why he came. Christ came down at Christmas to let us know that God knows our pain and our troubles. God came to be with us, to bear our burdens, to suffer our pains. He's not separated from the pain and the loneliness and the heartbreak that so many feel. He knows, he understands, and he cares. The Christmas story is that we can, because of God's grace and mercy, start with new hope, and forgiveness is possible, and mercy is available. And then thirdly, he is a God who came to exalt the righteous. All the way through Mary's song, there was this affirmation of victory that God was a God who would honor Abraham and the promise he made. That promise was that if they trusted him and do his will, he would make them a great nation. What Mary was singing was that God would do that. Those who loved him and followed him would be the victors. Now, it didn't seem like it, but this is what Mary says in verses 51 to 53. He has performed mighty deeds with his arm. He has scattered those who are proud in their inmost thoughts. He has brought down the rulers from their thrones, but has lifted up the humble. He has filled the hungry with good things, but has sent the rich away empty. God turns everything upside down, doesn't he? What's the overall message of the Magnificat? Mary's heart is filled with praise because she knows the world's going to be a different place because of Christ's coming. When Mary was praising God that he chose her in spite of her lowly status, she was showing the pattern that God always follows. He shows mercy to those who don't deserve it. He chooses the lowly over the proud. He finds the hungry and he fills them. And the rich of the world are sent away empty. He always keeps his promises, even though it means reversing the false values of human society. When God sent his son, he deliberately took the side of the forgotten people of the world. And he still does the same thing today. Now, if we were going to plan the birth of Jesus, we wouldn't do it that way, would we? We'd get on the phone, we'd call the major networks, we'd plan a big press conference with all the major news anchors. We'd have Jesus arriving in great pomp and circumstance. After all, that's the least you'd do for the Son of God. That's how he's supposed to come. First class, pull out all the stops, red carpet treatment, spare no expense. But that's not the way God does business. When God wanted to send his son into the world, he picked the most unlikely girl he could find to be the mother. She was a girl from a little hick town out from the beaten path there in the hill country in a forgotten province of the Roman Empire. He arranged so that his son would become a part of the hated Jewish race. Then he found the most unlikely hometown and arranged for his son to be born in a stable and take his first nap in a feeding trough. Jesus was born that way in order to send us a message about how God does business. Mary's song teaches us this is how God always does business. He doesn't do business with the proud. He doesn't run with the rulers of the world. He doesn't side with the rich. God is at home with the humble, the tired, the weak, and the lowly of this world. Now, in our day, it seems that those who serve God are not the ones who are winning, but losing. It seems that the people most idolized, the people perceived as having made it, are those who have neglected God. They seem to be the ones who live for pleasure and for satisfying their desires. They seem to have everything they want, and we may find ourselves at time envying them. Whole TV shows, scores of magazines are dedicated to the Hollywood elite, the rich and the famous. And the average person thinks that these people have it made and envies them. Others idolize the powerful business executives of a Fortune 500 company who flies everywhere in personal jets and meets with dignitaries from other countries and throws parties and makes headlines and has the power to go anywhere and do whatever. People envy that kind of person. But whoever notices the person who may be living decently, trying to do what's right in home and community, who is faithful to spouse and children, who is a faithful church member, who seeks to care for the needy in the community, who puts in an honest day's work for what seems like an ever-decreasing paycheck, who mentors grade schoolers or coaches Little League baseball simply because he loves kids, who tries in a way that he can to make his bit of the world a better place to live in. She probably doesn't make the headlines. She never really gains much power, but just gets by paying the bills at the end of the month. Who notices her? Who sets her up as a way to live? God does. God does. Friends, life is a gift from God, and he gave it to us, and only when we live it his way will we get the most out of it. And he tells us that when we give, we will find. When we lose, we will receive. When we do it his way, we will truly live. But if we do it his way, what we will discover in the midst of our lives is life, is a sense of joy and a sense of hope and a sense of peace. I'll close with this. While working as a journalist for the Chicago Tribune, Lee Strobel was assigned to report on the struggles of an impoverished inner-city family during the weeks leading up to Christmas. A confirmed atheist at the time, Strobel was mildly surprised by the family's attitude in spite of their circumstances, and I quote him, "The Delgados, 60-year-old Perfecta and her granddaughters Lydia and Jenny, had been burned out of their roach-infested tenement and were now living in a tiny two-room apartment on the west side. As I walked in, I couldn't believe how empty it was. There was no furniture, no rugs, nothing on the walls, only a small kitchen table and one handful of rice. That's it. They were virtually devoid of possessions. In fact, 11-year-old Lydia and 13-year-old Jenny owned only one short-sleeved dress each, plus one thin gray sweater between them. When they walked the half mile to school through the biting cold, Lydia would wear the sweater for part of the distance and then hand it to her shivering sister, who would wear it the rest of the way. But despite their poverty and the painful arthritis that kept Perfecta from working, she still talked confidently about her faith in Jesus. She was convinced he had not abandoned them. I never sensed despair or self-pity in her home. Instead, there was a gentle feeling of hope and peace." Now, Strobel completed his article, and then he moved on to work more high-profile assignments. But when Christmas Eve arrived, he found his thoughts drifting back to the Delgados and their unflinching belief in God's providence. In his words, "I continued to wrestle with the irony of the situation. Here was a family that had nothing but faith and yet seemed happy, while I had everything I needed materially but lacked faith, and inside I felt as empty and barren as their apartment." In the middle of a slow news day, Strobel decided to visit the Delgados, and when he arrived, he was amazed at what he saw. readers of his article have responded to the family's need in overwhelming fashion, filling the small apartment with donations. Once inside, Strobel encountered new furniture, appliances and rugs, a large Christmas tree, stacks of Christmas presents, bags of food, and a large selection of warm winter clothing. Readers had even donated a generous amount of cash. But it wasn't the gifts that shocked Strobel, an atheist, in the middle of Christmas generosity. It was the family's response to those gifts. In his words, "As surprised as I was by this outpouring, I was even more astonished by what my visit was interrupting. Perfecta and her granddaughters were getting ready to give away much of their newfound wealth. When I asked Perfecta why, she replied in halting English, 'Our neighbors are still in need. We cannot have plenty while they have nothing. This is what Jesus would want us to do.'" That blew me away. If I had been in their position at that time in my life, I would have been hoarding everything. I asked Perfecta what she thought about the generosity of the people who had sent all these goodies. And again, her response amazed me. "This is wonderful. This is very good," she said, gesturing toward the largesse. "We did nothing to deserve this. It is a gift from God. But," she added, "it is not his greatest gift. No, we celebrate that tomorrow. That is Jesus." To her, this child in the manger was the undeserved gift that meant everything. More than material possessions, more than comfort, more than security. And at that moment, something inside of me wanted desperately to know this Jesus, because in a sense, I saw him in Perfecta and her granddaughters. They had peace despite poverty, while I had anxiety despite plenty. They knew the joy of generosity, while I only knew the loneliness of ambition. They looked heavenward for hope, while I only looked out for myself. They experienced the wonder of the spiritual, while I was shackled to the shallowness of the material. And something made me long for what they had, or more accurately, for the one they knew. We want to focus our attention now on the one they knew, Jesus, as we celebrate why he came to us, as we celebrate Holy Communion together.